This program is a presentation of UCTV for educational and non-commercial use only.
I'm going to focus today a little bit on the nature of terrorism and extremist terrorist groups, their political strategies, and then discuss what this implies for the United States and how to respond to terrorist attacks. Let me begin first with a sort of a definition of what is terrorism. We use the term a lot. We don't often know exactly what we mean by it. I'm going to define for purposes of discussion for today, terrorism quite broadly as the irregular use of violence by non-state groups for political ends. There's some ambiguity here as to where simple criminal activity ends and terrorism starts, and where terrorism ends and war starts. So it's not entirely clear exactly what we mean by this term. But it's, I think this definition is sufficient for the purposes of our discussion today. This ambiguity in exactly what we mean by terrorism and where you draw the line between terrorism and other sorts of activities suggests that, in fact, terrorism exists in many forms. It changes over time, different locales, and is a quite general phenomenon. We're particularly concerned today with something that goes by the name of extremist terrorism, such as that which we experienced on September 11th. What do we mean by extremist terrorism or extremist violence? Or more simply, what does it mean to be an extremist in politics? Well, here too, we also lack a clear definition, as extremism is often in the eye of the beholder. But following on the earlier definition, I want to suggest, again for purposes of discussion, that an extremist is someone who holds to goals that they currently lack the means or power to obtain. A moderate is typically somebody who's willing to negotiate, to compromise for what is possible, who recognizes that there's sort of a give and take in politics. To get something, you often need to give up some other valued attribute. An extremist is somebody who overreaches, as it were, who wants something that is beyond his or her grasp and refuses to settle for less. Osama bin Laden, for instance, as best we can figure out, wants to force the United States to withdraw from the Middle East, especially Saudi Arabia, wants to destroy Israel, to create fundamentalist regimes throughout the Islamic world, and to stop the West from polluting Islamic culture. At the moment, he and his organization lack the means to realize any of these objectives. They simply don't have the ability to force the United States to withdraw from the Middle East. There's no expectation that there's a bargain. There's been no offer made. There's been no offer received. Nobody's bargaining with Osama bin Laden at the moment. Thus, we call him an extremist, somebody who is holds to goals that they can't realize, but that are, in fact, non-negotiable because of this extremist label. Well, because extremists hold goals that they lack the means to obtain, they must somehow shift the balance of power towards themselves. This is sort of the prime attribute or characteristic of the political strategies in which they engage. The wanton destruction of property and lives in the target state is designed in a cold, cruel, and calculating way to bring about this shift in power towards the extremists. Constrained by their relative weakness, extremists adopt strategies with two general characteristics. First, in a form of political jujitsu, extremists use the strengths of the target against itself. On September 11th, we saw how a free, democratic, modern, industrialized society can be seized from within to inflict massive damage upon itself. Although it undoubtedly took substantial planning and training, it took little in the way of advanced weaponry, few actual individuals to turn airplanes into bombs that could be used to attack the United States from within. Also constrained by their relative weakness, leads to the second characteristic, is that extremists seek to provoke a response from the target that through its disproportionate and indiscriminate nature punishes the broad population of which the terrorists are part. This retaliatory strategy, in turn, politically undermines and physically harms the moderates in the extremist home society. These former moderates then become radicalized and ally with the extremists either out of solidarity or out of fear. It's by provoking such a response that the extremists seek to drive the moderates into their own arms, into an alliance with them, thereby enlarging the group of supporters and augmenting the powers of these extremist groups. For instance, Timothy McVeigh sought to provoke a backlash by what he perceived as a repressive American state. And by provoking this backlash, he hoped to reveal for all Americans just how oppressive the U.S. government had become. He expected the government, when challenged, to crack down on dissidents, to restrict civil liberties, and thereby cause the people to rise up against it. At the start of the civil war in Bosnia, Serb extremists desecrated Serb graves, a heinous act, it was believed, at the time, that could only have been carried out by the antagonistic ethnic group, the Croats. As the Serbs rose to defend themselves and the Croats armed in response, a cycle of violence was set off that polarized that society, drove it into two distinct groups. In essence, by provoking Serb fears of the Croats, the extremists succeeded in transforming all Bosnian Serbs into extremists, and thereby became that much more powerful relative to the Croats. And the intent of bin Laden, as best we understand it, was to provoke a massive retaliation by the United States against Islamic countries, thereby revealing for all Muslims just how imperialist and anti-Islamic the U.S. government is. Suffering under American military assaults, moderates in the Arab world would then come to see the U.S. as the extremists see it, and in turn would ally with the extremists, again, augmenting the power and numbers of the extremist groups. It's precisely because the extremists are too weak relative to their ambitions that they must resort to the strategy of baiting the target into overly aggressive acts. When this strategy works, the extremists increase their numbers and bargaining power, and what was initially impossible becomes possible. And think here of sort of an example that played out over decades is the extremist groups in the Arab-Israeli conflict, who for decades baited Israel into retaliation, polarized politics within the Middle East, steadily grew in strength as the extremists, as the moderates were driven into the arms of the extremists, and are now bargaining from a position of strength over a Palestinian homeland. The dynamics changed over the decades as these provocative acts caused the retaliation, which in turn caused the polarization of Middle Eastern society. How should the United States then respond? Well, given the nature of this extremist terrorism, the United States has gotten the response pretty much right so far. On the one hand, the United States is attempting to destroy the terrorist organizations to prevent further attacks. This is not deterrence, but rather dismantlement, destruction of the terrorist organizations. It's a necessary part of a broader political strategy. At the same time, the United States has avoided the disproportionate response that the terrorists expected. Indeed, we've avoided that massive response upon which they predicated their strategy. So far, the United States has engaged in a limited and targeted attempt to rout out bin Laden and his Taliban supporters. Nothing would have been worse for the United States than to react massively not only against Afghanistan, but also against other largely Islamic countries that harbor and train terrorists. Such an action would have been guaranteed to frighten many into a far stronger anti-American coalition, and we would have played directly into the hands of the terrorists who carried out the attacks on September 11th. A massive retaliation would undoubtedly have been gratifying for an American ego deeply wounded by the terrorist attacks of September 11th. And certainly many within the Bush administration supported this approach, perhaps even the president himself in the early days when he declared war not just on bin Laden, not just on the Taliban, but on evil, broadly defined. Fortunately, cooler heads have prevailed. Okay, thank you. Yet pressure for a more aggressive response may arise if our limited and targeted attacks do not produce results in the short term or if additional attacks occur. But the bottom line is that in cases of extremist terrorism, restraint can be a wise policy. It prevents the strategy that the terrorists themselves are employing from succeeding. Let me conclude by reflecting a little bit on what September 11th has taught us. The attacks of September 11th have been a wake-up call to the United States that the world has been changing while our military and security policy has not. It's not that the world is suddenly different, but our understanding of that world has changed. The growth of terrorism has been a slow and incremental process unfolding over decades. It just didn't change on September 11th. Our understanding of it did. But what do we now know? Well, three things, I think. War is global. The United States is no longer invulnerable to attacks on its own soil. We have long enjoyed an insulated existence behind our oceanic moats. But on September 11th, we joined the ranks of ordinary countries who are always vulnerable to military actions, to hostile actions from foreign threats. Second, war is now personal. Once upon a time, only states could mobilize the massive military forces necessary for war. This reached its zenith, if you will, during the Cold War, when only two superpowers could compete militarily. Today, states are still necessary for some forms of military power, but the attacks of September 11th have demonstrated a small, determined group of individuals can now exert tremendous harm. It no longer requires a government to declare war. And third, is an enduring lesson, is that war is, as always, political. And our military strategy must be subordinated to our political strategy, or we shall create more enemies for the future than we eliminate today. Thank you.
I wanted to stress that on September 11th, the United States, the American people, became significantly less secure. Indeed, we're probably less secure today than we have been at any time in recent history. It's difficult to find a period in recent history that compares with the fear we've felt recently, and to find a period in which, in fact, we are personally vulnerable to attack from foreign powers. Perhaps the only recent scares that parallel this would be maybe the bomb shelter scare at the time of the missile gap in the late 1950s and early 1960s. And yet that's not comparable because, in fact, as we now know, that was largely based on a fantasy of a missile gap that didn't exist. The attacks on New York City and Washington, D.C. are important because they shook a myth that it does not pay to attack the United States. The attacks didn't destroy the myth, but they did put it in jeopardy of falling. It's a myth that the United States has cultivated by its own previous policies, including our decisive and overwhelming response to the attack on Pearl Harbor in 1941. It's a myth that we carefully cultivated throughout the Cold War by our statements, by our capabilities, by our responses to small probes. The United States made credible the threat that any attack on the United States would be costly to the perpetrator. The myth slowly eroded under incremental assaults on American assets, particularly in the 1990s, in incremental assaults on American assets overseas. These included, most recently, the attack on the American vessel in the Yemeni harbor, earlier attacks on the American embassies in August of 1998, the still earlier attack on the World Trade Center in February of 1993. As Americans, we all share an interest in restoring this myth. We share an interest that other people and other governments around the world believe that it does not pay to attack the United States. If they do not believe this, then all of us will be significantly less secure in our daily lives. The response to the attack will inevitably require a very complex policy. The usual guidelines for combating terrorism in the voluminous literature stress a complex mix of coercion, inducement, and prophylaxis. Coercion means engaging the opponent's armed forces and destroying them in military engagements. Inducement means imposing costs on the other side through retaliation, so that our opponent loses more than it might have hoped to have gained by its terrorism. And prophylaxis means attempting to address the grievances that sustain the causes on behalf of which the terror was used. Any policy must include all three elements of coercion, inducement, and prophylaxis. And this must be directed not only against the terrorist organization itself, such as the Al-Qaeda network, but also directed at its allies, such as the Taliban government of Afghanistan. A central purpose of this action must be to influence the future behavior of the Al-Qaeda network and the Taliban government. But more importantly, a central purpose of this action must be to influence the many copycats. Other movements and other governments who might be emboldened to follow the example of either Al-Qaeda or the Taliban if they come to believe that attacking the United States pays. So in designing a policy that will reestablish the myth that it does not pay to attack the United States requires several broad outlines. Let me list five of these very briefly. First of all, the primary purpose, as I've said, of our policy must be to reestablish the myth that it does not pay to attack the United States. And we should be focusing on shaping the expectations of third parties, such as the government of Iraq, the government of Sudan. And we should keep in mind that we are also trying to shape the expectation of future governments that are not yet in power, that we cannot yet imagine. Secondly, the policy must be multifaceted. It must focus on destroying the war-making capabilities of Al-Qaeda and the Taliban, imposing some high costs on them, such as a loss of political power or a loss of their state, and removing those unnecessary irritants that lead others to ally with the terrorists and provide them support. That is, our policy must balance coercion, inducement, and prophylaxis. To the credit of the Bush administration, and I'm not someone who frequently credits them for many things, they appear to appreciate this. For example, the administration is attempting to distance the United States from policies of Israel in the West Bank and the Gaza, which are, from our perspectives, simply an irritant and a source of major problems for us. Thirdly, the response probably must be opportunistic. That is, we must concentrate our energies in responding on those aspects of the complex terrorist organization over which we have the most leverage, and that will give the greatest deterrent effect on copycats. Successful terrorist organizations require a very complex combination of at least three core ingredients: a small conspiratorial organization of fighters, or professional revolutionaries, as Lenin called them decades ago, a larger movement of supporters who provide conspirators protection, supplies, and intelligence, and allied governments or political vacuums that provide safe havens for the conspirators. It's not easy for the United States to influence all three of these elements. Finding conspiratorial organizations may be like finding a needle in the haystack, as we've been reminded over and over again. And moreover, success in that fight may come in small, secret engagements that have minimal deterrent effect. In addition, shaping the sympathies of supporting populations may take decades or even longer. Moreover, there are some things that we would need to do to end their hatred towards us, things that we simply are unwilling or incapable of giving away, such as the State of Israel. As a consequence, we need to focus on where we do have leverage, and that often means focusing on the allied government, in this instance, the Taliban government, the Taliban regime. This may be the critical link in the terrorist formula over which we have the most leverage. Without supporting governments, it may be very difficult to sustain the type of large-scale, coordinated attack that took place on September 11th. Moreover, actions against the Taliban government are likely to be dramatic public events that have maximum deterrent effect on potential copycats. Fourth, the costs that we inflict on the Taliban must be massive and certain of success. That is, in deciding what type of retaliation and how much retaliation to bring against the Taliban, we should keep in mind that our purpose is to convince others that it does not pay to attack the United States. This means we must imagine ourselves in the position of these governments and ask ourselves, if we were fanatics, what would we value? What would we not want to lose? And that's what we should go after. It also means picking your objectives prudently so that we are most certain of success. Unfortunately, the Bush administration can probably be faulted on this point. It appears to have defined our objective in a way that increases the chances of failure. Rather than committing ourselves to bringing Osama bin Laden to justice and creating a new coalition government to replace the Taliban, we might have simply declared Afghanistan a failed experiment and announced that we would recognize secessionist governments that sought to create a Hazaristan, a Mazar-i-Sharifistan, and encourage neighboring states like Iran and Pakistan to create protectorates in a new Baluchistan or Pashtunstan. And fifth and finally, the objectives that we set in the conflict in Afghanistan should not take long to achieve. Unfortunately, again, the Bush administration can probably be faulted on these grounds as well. We're committed to a long-term military campaign, yet any long-term military action against Afghanistan is likely to erode international support. We are committed to creating a new coalition government for Afghanistan among parties that do not want to work together. Any long-term occupation of Afghanistan in support of a shaky coalition government is likely to erode American support as well. Having said this, I don't mean to minimize the importance of trying to take action in which we minimize the loss of Afghan and American lives, and we should continue to work with the Global Committee to create a world order in which it is unacceptable to engage in terrorism. But we must keep in sight that our primary objective is to reduce the chances that 5,000 Americans will again lose their lives in the types of terrorist attacks that we saw on September 11th.
Those of you who are students here know that I teach both about Vietnam and what goes on in a country during an internal war and about American politics and policymaking. And it's very seldom that the subjects of terror and the after effects are talked about in the context of what happens inside the United States. And I want to talk about the problems that any administration would have at a time like this in balancing the need to sell programs to the American people and keep a coalition going and to do the things that really work, which in some cases are very different from the things that keep us behind the program, and to help us focus on the real challenges that will be ahead for President Bush and Secretary Powell and Secretary Rumsfeld, because it's an extraordinarily difficult job to manage something as difficult and amorphous. I think history will show that it was an inevitable and very regrettable fact that we declared war on terrorism. It's impossible not to have a great crime without a great reaction. But like the war on poverty, the war on drugs, the war on illiteracy, it's extremely hard to declare war on something that you can manage and minimize, but never really eliminate. And we've got lots of problems ahead in the management. And I think we're very, very fortunate that several of the people on the president's team have had so much experience with trying to do things that didn't work in the past. Secretary Rumsfeld, for example, was the White House chief of staff for President Bush in 1976. And when an American freighter was captured by the new Khmer Rouge government in Cambodia, we felt it was necessary to react immediately to free the crew of the freighter Mayaguez, and 44 Marines were killed invading the wrong island. And both Rumsfeld and Cheney were in Washington when President Nixon was in the White House, and we launched a raid into North Vietnam to free prisoners, and we raided a prisoner of war camp that had been empty for 6 months. And they're very aware of the problems of actually getting intelligence together. A president at a time like this has to balance passion and patience. He needs to keep enough passion alive in the country to get support for what's going to be a very messy war. If there's not a feeling of passion, how is he going to sustain support when the body bags come home? On the other hand, if he's going to lash out and react very quickly, how long will he be able to keep up powerful overreactions in the eyes of other parts of the world if we don't get immediate results? So we've got a serious problem of balancing how long this can go on without any objective results, as we've seen so far. So far we have really no results. We have the problem of we know how many trucks we've destroyed, we know how many airports we've destroyed, we know how many tanks we've disabled, but tanks, trucks, and airports are not terrorism. So far, we can't say that we have made any progress on terrorism, and it's likely really to be a long time before we can. Professor Lake and Professor Roeder both spoke very well about the problems of overreacting, making the terrorists into martyrs, showing us to be callous, insensitive, racist, and inflaming the people who send their children to be martyrs. We also have the problem of possibly enhancing the moral glamour of the terrorists if we do nothing about them, if we show them to be effective. We have to balance the whether we look like we're afraid or we look like we're callous. If we plan forever to do things in an antiseptic way, will people think that we're slow because we know what we're doing, or will people think we're slow because we're terrified and haven't a clue what's going on? This is a problem for any administration dealing with something as difficult as this. This is, in the new world of these kinds of wars, it's not just a matter of eliminating Osama bin Laden. If the only thing that mattered was eliminating Osama bin Laden, a small nuclear device in three or four mountain passes would have a very good chance of eliminating him. But, of course, that is about as logical a response as would have been using nuclear weapons in Vietnam to destroy the dikes in the Red River Delta. If you eliminate this one person by irradiating half of a country, does that count as a victory? Or do you lose on style points and have more trouble the next time? So, you know, not trying to be callous, but there is a problem of how war is different today for our military than in the past. In World War II, very few people during the war said, you shouldn't destroy the port if there's any orphanages near the ball bearing factories. We did save Kyoto thanks to Ambassador Reischauer, who said, you know, bomb another city, this one's too precious. But very seldom Very seldom in previous wars was our military told it's not just whether or not you eliminate the enemy, but it's whether you do it in a style and manner that makes the other people think we're a good cop instead of a callous, clumsy cop. And I think one thing that will help our administration a lot to be more patient than one might have expected is the extraordinary outpouring of patriotism and caring there's been in this country. I mean, there are groups in this country where I don't think people had ever owned a flag before who are waving flags and, you know, feeding firemen in New York and taking care of people. And anybody who goes to the theater or a game, when you see suddenly the different reaction to the Star Spangled Banner or America the Beautiful, sees how much this has mobilized people. And as long as that lasts, the government and the military have some time to work on this. A problem that the government has been facing and has not handled so well in the eyes of many people, and is one of the first cracks in the unity, is the problem of dealing with an issue like anthrax. When you're dealing with the possibilities of epidemics, no matter how remote, no matter how difficult, you've got to balance the problem of starting a panic and the problem of preventing the diseases. If you tell everybody never open the mail, you've got one kind of panic. If you tell everybody what to do, you've got another problem, and it's an extremely difficult balancing act. Everybody is starting the Monday morning quarterbacking of they shouldn't have given CPRO to Congress till they gave CPRO to the post office. Was the Senate right to stay in session, or was the House right to go home? This is new territory for everybody. The problems have been around. There have been simulations of epidemics, but nobody really takes them seriously and plans how to deal with them. If our Congress men and women had been spending the last 3 years planning for how to deal with an anthrax attack, people would have said they were Cold War nuts from Orange County who were ignoring the real problems of education or conservation. And now they have to play catch up. And we have some of the same problems for the military in adapting, and for the president in selling the military strategies he chooses to the country. We have not had over 200 casualties in any country since the truck bomb killed 240 people in Lebanon 20 years ago. We have to deal with casualties, and it's not clear that the American people, the House, the Senate, or the President is ready. As one military person said in the New York Times, the Clinton administration tried to avoid casualties by doing everything with bombs and missiles. The Bush administration is trying to avoid casualties by doing everything with special forces. At some point, the myth that a few hundred of the best fighters in the world with the best helicopters, goggles, night vision, and rifles will do that much better than Russians when it's 40 below in the mountains of Afghanistan will be gone, and we'll have to deal with the problem of how do we put forces in and where if we're going to do something in this country. And that's going to be very hard because all of the American intelligence agencies have become bureaucratic and have not been dealing with on-the-ground realities in this part of the world. Now, Congressman Jack Brooks said years ago, one of the great sayings, every disaster is an opportunity. And we don't just mean the hitchhikers on the war against and the war against and the road to ending terrorism who think that a tax cut or drilling in Alaska will weaken the terrorists. But you have a situation where every single branch of the armed services, after all, they're patriots. That's what they're here for. They all think they're the ones who should be given the big bucks to do what it takes to get rid of terrorism. And it's likely that new kinds of units for new kinds of wars are going to be required and cause a real conflict within the Pentagon and the Senate over reallocating our military money.
Thank you. It's interesting to say about the effect of September 11th. In the absence of September 11th, The lead story of the New York Times would be about recession or our attempts to deal with it, the splits in Congress. And that gets pushed off not only to the lower left side, but often to the back pages. So I don't talk today about how we might understand the effect of September 11th on the economy. And there are at least two really important things to keep in mind. We may, when we write the history, 20 or 30 years of the U.S. macroeconomy, remember this is the bin Laden recession. But in fact, at least at this particular moment, it's really the technology bursting recession. The United States economy grew at a rate of about 2 or 3/10 of 1% in the second quarter of 2001. We have this technical definition of a recession. It's not quite exactly right, but close enough, that a recession is 2/4 of negative growth. So economists sort of predicting about recessions were sort of arguing, would we have 1/10 of a percent positive growth or be in a recession with 2 or 3/10 percent negative growth? But in fact, the economy was doing relatively poorly. It's very hard to tell an economy that's growing at 2/10 of 1% positively from 2/10 of 1% negatively. So we were clearly in bad economic times before 9/11, and most of what's going on at this particular second probably should be thought of as a cyclical recession rather than the effects of 9/11. There were very special things having to do with particular industries, say with the airline industry, with tourism, with things on the border in San Diego that really are related to 9/11. But even there, think about airlines. Before 9/11, we had eight major airlines in the United States. Many people thought that by the end of the year, we would have somewhere between 4 and 6. Swiss Air, which declared bankruptcy after 9/11 and was bailed out, was well known to be going to bankruptcy because of some disastrous financial decisions it had made beforehand, well before any thought of terrorism. So lots of the effects, even in the airline industry, really have to do with cyclical problems in the airline industry, having nothing to do with 9/11. So we look at policy, we look at what's going on. We have to remember that we really were in a recession in any event. 9/11 exacerbated it in many ways, but lots of what's going on really is a traditional post-boom recession. Very important to keep that in mind. Second thing that's very important to keep in mind is the United States is a $10 trillion economy. California is close to $2 trillion. San Diego is close to around $100 billion. These are large, diverse economies. As we watch things on TV news, we'll see lots of stories about the plight of airline workers. We'll see about the plight of people in the tourism industry. And again, it's easy for me, not working in either of those industries, to say these are minor things. But in the scheme of a $10 trillion economy, lots of things that CBS Evening News treats as large are, in fact, relatively small. So we have a large, diverse economy. It's an economy that's going through certainly a cyclical recession, and in the long term, whatever that is, will sort of work its way out of that. Turning to the politics, it's really quite wonderful. All the things that we teach in Poli Sci 10 about American politics continue to work in the face of this horrible tragedy. So right after 9/11, the airline industry got together and said, we have serious problems. Again, many of those problems, pre-9/11 problems, exacerbated, obviously, by not being able to run for a couple of days, exacerbated by problems in insurance and such. So again, lots of post-9/11 problems, but lots of pre-9/11 problems. Within a day, they had organized their lobbyists. One of their chief lobbyists happens to be the wife of the Democratic majority leader in the Senate. And within a week, using our standard Poli Sci 10 sorts of tools, they had themselves a bailout of $15 billion. So unlike my poor colleagues in international relations who have to sort of figure out how to deal with the sort of new terrorism and such, it does look like, in terms of domestic economic policy, that we can almost think of this as politics as usual. The standard joke at this point is, Washington politics, I'm shocked. In fact, in some sense, it's interesting, 9/11 actually solves one major economic problem. We always find some good coming out of anything. Up until 9/11, we had this problem that we were running a surplus of about $150 billion. That entire surplus was basically the surplus in the Social Security Fund. At this particular moment, the Social Security taxes exceed Social Security spending by about $150 billion a year. We had a much larger surplus than that before, but we spent the rest of it in a series of tax cuts. Okay? If you looked at, again, the political maneuvering right before 9/11, the Democrats were accusing the Republicans of eating into the trust fund by something like $5 to $10 billion, and the Republicans were denying it and saying their accounting was good. Those were the political fights. But in a recession, we know that running a surplus of $150 billion is a bad thing. We've been fighting this recession primarily by monetary policy. We had unprecedented cuts in interest rates. Basically, the Federal Reserve, I think, had in some sense almost run out of sort of serious policy stuff that it could do. And we were stuck with this $150 billion surplus, which, whether it's Social Security funds or anything else, looks like a drag on the economy. Okay, post 9/11, all of a sudden, our fears of whether we were eating into the, what we were doing with the Social Security lockbox disappeared, and we have now stimulative policy, roughly $100 to $150 billion. And again, the beauty is, in terms of American politics, in the House controlled by the Republicans, we get a bill which has most of the tax cuts going to corporations, relatively little going to poor people. We have the Democrats in the Senate who will change this around and try to get tax cuts going to poor people and try to get much more spending, public work spending, the traditional kinds of things they do. So if you simply looked at what's going on in terms of stimulative policy, in terms of tax cuts in the House and Senate, you would say, 9/11, I don't really notice much of that at all. It looks like exactly the kind of stuff that we did before, other than that we don't have to sort of worry about the lockbox. Who's right here? Well, that's sort of not my job to say. If you talk to a Democratic economist, you will find that the Democrats are right. And if you talk to a Republican economist, you will find the Republicans are right. A couple of things we do know. One is that typically things like public work spending take place long after the recession's over. In terms of tax cuts, we can get money into the hands of people who spend it. But we know that, at least we think, that this will be a relatively short recession. So that set of either tax cuts or spending, which will take place in 2 or 3 years, are not the kinds of things that are going to have much effect on this particular recession. Most political economists have sort of given up on fiscal policy, on tax cuts or increased government spending, on the grounds that that's always just took place long after the recession's over. Perhaps in these amazing times, we can actually get some money out to people while the recession's still going on. But as you evaluate the various policies, ask yourself which of these are going to get money out into the hands of people while the recession's going on, and which are going to have an effect 2 or 3 years down the road when most people think the recession will be over. What's the specific effect of 9/11? Well, if you look at the casualty loss in New York, I'm not going to come close to discussing how we value the loss of 5,000 people, so let's simply stick to casualty loss. It's around something like $50 billion. Again, big number, but to put that in perspective, Hurricane Andrew, the previous largest casualty loss, was about $20 billion. We do not remember the recession, the Andrew recession. For those of you in California, Northridge, about $17 billion. Okay, we have a lot of studies on the effect of this. If we think of this as sort of a single disaster, the effect of these disasters, and it turns out they simply do not show up in the macroeconomy. Basically, you get a lot of rebuilding. That is stimulative policy. We've destroyed a lot, so that's bad. But the effect of a $50 billion loss in the long term, in terms of, again, writing the history of the U.S. macroeconomy, probably would not show up. What are the long-term consequences going to be? Well, we learned in the 1990 recession, and we're really, really, really good at fighting the last recession. We come to understand recessions after they pass, just like with earthquakes, is that consumer confidence is critical. Consumer spending is about two-thirds of GDP. If consumers continue, well, consumers were not spending because they're worried about their jobs, again, this long-term cyclical recession. But in terms of 9/11, the question is that going to cause people not to spend? Is that going to cause people not to go to malls and so forth? And the answer is we don't know. At this particular moment, we know that in late September, there was this precipitous drop in consumer spending. We know that there's still certainly a decline in things like airline traffic. We also know that, the automobile companies have engaged in this tremendous price war, to some extent giving away cars at no profit. And October looks like about the best month in terms of sales, not profits, because there's no profits, but in terms of sales, we can get people out there to buy cars. If you offer people cars with no interest, they'll buy cars. So it looks, at least at this particular second, the happy story is consumer spending may stay up and the stimulative policy may work. The bad news, of course, is as we get the next anthrax letter or the next God knows what else is going to come, will that cause people not to go to malls? Will November look like the latter part of September if people are not shopping and not going to malls, they're not buying things? That, in some sense, is the sort of the trillion-dollar question and the one we sort of don't know the answer to. At this particular moment, it looks again like a cyclical recession. We're fairly good at dealing with cyclical recessions. Fiscal policy may, in fact, work. We'll have a fairly short recession and not a particularly deep one. I checked the news, from the New York Times just before I left, hoping that nothing horrible had happened, because 3, 4, 5 more horrible things, people are not going to spend, and then all bets are off. So the question at this point is, do we have sort of a cyclical recession, or will we remember the depression of the first decade of the 21st century as the bin Laden recession? Right now we have the bubble-bursting recession of 2001.
We've been hearing a lot, properly, about the domestic implications of all of this. I want to turn to what I think are the implications for the Middle East. Although the military campaign that we're now conducting with our allies is taking place in Afghanistan and is directed in a network that ranges over more than 60 countries, including our own, it's clear that the threat we face emanates from the Middle East. We therefore need to understand the regional roots of this eruption in order to deal with it, both in the short term and in the long term. This conflict is sometimes referred to as a clash of civilizations. I think it's better understood, and I mean this not rhetorically, but almost literally, as a clash between civilization and barbarism. The Middle East does not have a monopoly on modern terrorism. Many Muslims who understand their traditions to call for restraints on the use of force, especially against non-combatants, and against suicide, even as an act of war, are just as appalled by this event as the rest of us. But at the same time, it is also true that from Algeria to Sudan to Egypt to Iran to Turkey and to Afghanistan, there are many in the Islamic world who interpret their religion as a call to arms against those whom they consider infidels and apostates. These terrorists draw on a version of Islam which is sometimes called fundamentalist and sometimes Islamist. It emerged in Egypt and Pakistan in the 1920s and has spread since then in reaction to what is perceived as a threat of westernization and or modernization. To say that this Islamic terrorism is a reaction to American foreign policy, or that it expresses grievances against us, is therefore to misperceive its roots. The Algerian Islamist fundamentalists who have caused the death of tens of thousands of people did so not at all in reaction to any American foreign policy. The same is true for Sudan, where 2 million people have been killed in the civil war. The terrorists who assassinated Anwar Sadat didn't do so because of American foreign policy or even because he signed a treaty of peace with Israel. They did so because they regarded him as an apostate who had violated Islamic law. People do not commit suicidal acts of terrorism unless they are inspired or possessed by beliefs that justify such sacrifice. In this case, the belief that a fight in the cause of Islam against its enemies will bring the believer straight to heaven. Islam is open, especially to this interpretation, because it is by nature a religion that created a community of believers and not just a community of belief. The Prophet Muhammad was both a messenger of God and a political leader, a military commander, and a tax collector. The early caliphate, which fundamentalists claim to want to restore, was at once a spiritual and a political office. Over the long and complex history of the region, this original pattern was by no means always followed. There is considerable diversity in the Islamic tradition, but there have always been those who have insisted that deviations from the original path are a sign of impiety and a recipe for disaster. Unlike some religions, moreover, Islam is open to various interpretations. There's no equivalent for papal infallibility or for a synod that can declare some views orthodox and others heretical. Practically any mullah can issue a fatwa or religious edict, as Osama bin Laden has done in declaring a jihad, and if he gets enough people to follow him, they will all insist that they are the party of God, the literal meaning of Hezbollah. The stated aim of the terrorists led by bin Laden is twofold: to defend Islam from the infidels, that is to say Jews and Christians, and to overthrow so-called apostates who are in power in Islamic countries, presumably with the support of the infidels. We should not underestimate the appeal of this version of Islam. It is taught in 10,000 madrasas in Pakistan, for example. It is in power in Iran. It has produced political parties in Algeria, Turkey, and Egypt. These parties have been banned by secular regimes, fearful that if allowed to function, they would take over these societies. In Syria, the Muslim Brotherhood was crushed by a show of force. President Mubarak in Egypt has eliminated some, exiled others, imprisoned thousands, yet the movement survives. Osama bin Laden is a hero everywhere in the region, indeed throughout the Islamic world. One specialist has noted that Osama is the second most popular name now for Muslim children, second only to Muhammad. There are between 1 billion and 1.3 billion Muslims in the world. Many millions of them regard themselves as our enemies. Among Palestinians, 27% approved of the attack on the World Trade Center. Yasser Arafat, who is thought by some not to be an extremist but a moderate, sent a letter to the parents of the suicide bomber who attacked the Tel Aviv disco, praising him as a model Palestinian youth. How can we deal with this threat? We have no choice, it seems to me, but to stamp out as many of those who are conspiring against us as we can, by military means, by police and judicial work where possible, by blocking their funds and communications, and by protecting our most sensitive targets. The campaign requires that we eliminate their safe havens, first in Afghanistan and, if necessary, elsewhere. The longer it takes, however, the more civilians that are killed, the more risk there is that the governments of Pakistan, Egypt, and Saudi Arabia in particular will be threatened with overthrow. Pakistan is particularly dangerous because its nuclear weapons could fall into the hands of a regime friendly to the Taliban and Osama. And I've seen an estimate by at least one specialist on Pakistan who says that 80% of the people oppose the United States and favor Osama bin Laden. So the sooner we get this campaign over with, the better. But then we may well have to go on to deal with other states that harbor terrorism, possibly by military means, possibly by exerting pressure. I do want to say, however, that we have to do more than simply try to stamp out terrorism militarily. The reason for that is simply that so long as the conditions that generate this kind of notion survive, we will be threatened by future generations of Islamic terrorists. Ultimately, the threat that they pose will not be eliminated until the countries of the Middle East overcome their inability to modernize. That is, to my mind, the real source of fundamentalism, and it is not the policies we have pursued. It would be easy to show that we have tried hard to help the people of the region, including the Palestinians, to achieve self-determination, economic growth, and peace. But that misses the point. This terrorist movement aims to attack us and overthrow regimes that are friendly to us. We have no choice but to go after them with all the skill and determination we can muster. If we wanted to go into detail on the issue of American foreign policy in the Middle East, we would find that we went to war to liberate one Muslim country, Kuwait, that we are hardly responsible for the sufferings of the people of Iraq. They are victims of Saddam Hussein, who has used the money that he obtains from oil purchases to buy new weapons He used it to promote a war with Iran in which hundreds of thousands of people were killed. That is hardly a result of American policy. Similarly, the fact that that the Palestinians have not achieved a homeland is not a result of American foreign policy. When we supported the partition resolution that the UN passed, the UN General Assembly in 1948, that would have created a Palestinian state alongside a Jewish state if the Arabs had been willing to accept it. That the same thing was true later on, after 1967. If the Arab states had been willing to recognize Israel, there would have been a return of those territories, and possibly a Palestinian state could have been created. Between 1948 and 1967, the West Bank and Gaza were under Arab control. They could have created an Arab state at that point. And after the Camp David Accords, which we helped promote and brought the participants to the White House to celebrate, President Clinton worked extremely hard in order to get an agreement. When Yasser Arafat rejected that, nobody from the Arab world, including Saudi Arabia and Egypt, complained bitterly that he had forsaken an opportunity to bring about the creation of a Palestinian state. So I think to blame all of that on that's happened on the United States, when for many years we have criticized Israeli settlements, brokered the accord between Egypt and Israel. We have provided economic aid. We have provided protection to Arabs in Saudi Arabia and Kuwait. It is just obvious nonsense. And I cannot believe that alone is enough to account for terrorism. It seems to me that the more you study the outbreak of terrorism and the fundamentalism that lies behind it, the more you have to accept that this is a result of the failure of these states to modernize, and therefore what they're doing is blaming somebody whom they hold responsible other than themselves, blaming the West, when in fact it is their own fault. What can we do to help this situation? We can start by helping the reconstruction of Afghanistan. And if necessary, at some point, I hope we will be in a position to help the reconstruction of Iraq. So this to demonstrate that we are not necessarily against nation building. We are in favor of nation building, as we proved in the case of Germany and Japan after World War II. And indeed, I begin to feel that the only way we're going to turn the Middle East around is by active and creative intervention in it. Thank you.